KPFK in Los Angeles. This is Living in the USA. I'm John Wiener, talking about politics, thinking about the left. Later in the show, Amy Willance will talk about Biden's White House gala honoring Kenya for sending 1,000 police officers to Haiti. She calls it the devil's ball. And Amy Littlefield will report on the abortion pill underground. But first, almost 3,000 students have been arrested at more than 60 college campuses protesting American support for Israel's war in Gaza. Universities and colleges do have a responsibility to maintain order, but they must not sacrifice the principles of free speech that are core to their educational mission. How have they been doing? For that, we turn to Ben Wisner. He's director of the ACLU's Speech, Privacy, and Technology Project. Since 2013, he has been the principal legal advisor to NSA whistleblower Edward Snowden. We talk with him about that here. Ben Wisner, it's a pleasure to say, welcome back.
Nice to be here.
The ACLU sent an open letter to college and university presidents on student protests at the beginning of this protest season. We want now to look at how universities have done with that. Let's start with freedom of speech. Not hard to explain the principle. Speech must be protected, however offensive or false. All speech, regardless of viewpoint, unless it is directed as a threat to an individual. Safety from ideas or views that one finds offensive is anathema to the very enterprise of the university. That's what the ACLU says in its statement. So let's take some familiar examples. First of all, the chants, from the river to the sea, Palestine will be free, or globalize the Intifada. Some Jewish students have said they felt personally threatened by these chants. They say these are not calls for a binational democratic state. They're not calls for a ceasefire. To them, from the river to the sea, Palestine will be free means kill the Jews. And they point out that the second Intifada involved terror attacks on civilians in Israel, including famously suicide bombings on civilian targets. So to them, globalize the Intifada means kill Jews everywhere in the world. What do you say to those students?
Well, let's assume everyone here is acting and speaking in good faith. Let's assume that the protesters mean it when they say that their activism is not anti-Semitic, that it is against the Zionist project and not against the Jewish people. And let's accept at face value that Jewish students on campuses are deeply unsettled by these protests that take aim not at 1967, but at 1948 and the existence of a Jewish state. And that for them to hear these messages is quite painful. Accepting everyone at face value, we have to repeat that the law does not give you a right to avoid being offended, upset, unsettled, discombobulated, disturbed by the content of other people's speech. Now, we've certainly heard reports about the context of that speech that might actually cross the line. If a Jewish student were walking across a campus and were physically surrounded by protesters who were chanting that message into the student's face, that would be a different context than if the Jewish student is walking past a protest encampment and is hearing that message broadcast through signs and through other amplification. In that latter context, where it's actually the content really alone of the speech, not the conduct, not any kind of physical threat, not any targeting of, say, the student's dorm room, then we say, look, this is why it's hard to be a free speech advocate. This is exactly why it's hard. Because the only time that we need legal protection for free speech is when it genuinely offends or upsets other people. At all other times, it's cheap and easy to say that you're for free speech. But the only measure of whether someone is actually for free speech is when that person steps forward to defend speech that is genuinely upsetting or offensive to that person. And in this instance, there's a difference between safety and safetyism. You know, safetyism is the term that we use to describe this sense of entitlement that people should not have to confront ideas that offend them. Safety means that people should not be physically threatened and intimidated. And we have to distinguish between those two words in the college context.
And here's a different kind of example. UC Santa Barbara. There, the president of the student body is Jewish. Her name is Tessa Wexler. She posted on Instagram a sign on campus that said, quote, "Tesla Wexler supports genocide. You cannot hide," close quote. What do you say to that?
You know, it depends. If that had been posted on her dorm room door, there's no question that that could be viewed as a threat, that it would not have free speech protections, that the school would almost certainly have a legal obligation to take action to protect her from that kind of threat. If she were a public figure, if it were the university president, then I think probably that kind of speech would be at the edge of speech that a community would want to tolerate. But I think targeted at an undergraduate student, "you cannot hide" is threatening enough that a school that is subject to federal civil rights obligations would want to take steps to remove that kind of sign from its campus.
We've talked about chants and signs. Of course, we have to talk about the encampments, which occupy space often at the center of the campus and usually for weeks. The ACLU statement says, quote, "Protests can be limited to certain areas of campus and certain times of the day." Of course, the encampments violate that quite a bit. At UCLA, the chancellor said the Gaza protest encampment was interfering with the rights of students because, quote, "it directly interfered with instruction by blocking students' pathways to classrooms." The situation is that the encampment was in the center of campus. It did block a couple of the paths between buildings, which required that people walk around the encampment to get to their destination. Do students have a right to take the most direct path to class and not be required to walk around this kind of obstacle?
Well, in this particular case, it doesn't strike me as a question of rights on either side. Students probably don't have the right to have the most direct path to class, but they also don't have the right to have an encampment. This is a question of what a campus wants to tolerate. And here we're talking about what campuses should do, not what they must do. Basically, yeah. Every campus is going to have a rule that says that no group can unilaterally occupy a portion of campus indefinitely to the exclusion of others. So the encampments surely violate policies. And I don't think you can make a strong argument that the First Amendment requires public universities to allow these encampments to stay up. I think what we saw, though, in some instances was that there were campuses that had allowed encampments for other kinds of protests, say about climate or about fair wages and hours for staff.
At UCLA, which did call the police to remove the encampment, the Chicano Studies program was established decades ago because of an encampment that lasted 4 weeks with students demanding it. The university tolerated it and eventually created the Chicano Studies department.
Sure. And I remember growing up in New Haven in a college community that the encampments there about South African apartheid seem to have been tolerated for quite a longer amount of time than the pro-Gaza encampments that we saw this time. Of course, no two situations are identical. And I think that if you were interviewing the chancellor of UCLA, what that person would say is, in those other instances, there was not a sizable number of students on campus, members of our community, who were deeply offended and hurt by the message. And so in this situation, there were multiple constituencies that had to be balanced, whereas in some of those other situations, there was the nuisance factor, but you didn't have other members of the community who were expressing their grievance at this. Look, I don't think there's necessarily a right or wrong answer for how long should a university tolerate an encampment, even though its rules don't require it to. I thought that the president of the University of Chicago put out a very interesting statement about the encampment there. He said, look, this obviously violates our rules. We're going to allow it for as long as we can because we lean towards allowing freedom of expression. But I want to remind everyone who's engaged in this that there are a thousand other ways to protest on our campus that don't violate our rules. You can't say this is the only way to get your message across. And after a certain amount of time, the president decided that it was too disruptive to campus life to have it there. And I would say to those who are advocating that these encampments should be allowed to be there indefinitely, that remember that if you're a university, you have to at least aim for consistency in the enforcement of these laws. And so we should at least imagine if the encampment were, say, put up by Talking Points USA and it were a MAGA Trump four more years encampment, a message that many students believe is racist, even though its proponents insist that it's not. Would we feel the same way towards that encampment occupying that part of campus for that amount of time at that level of amplification? I can say honestly, I do take the same position. I would say that the schools should be tolerant, that they should call in police only as a last resort, and that people should base their response to it not on the content of the communications, but on the actual disruption that it causes. But I'm not sure that's how others would respond to that kind of message.
And of course, the next step in escalated tactics beyond the encampments is building occupations. At my school, UC Irvine, a radical faction of the Gaza protest encampment, occupied a lecture hall in a nearby classroom building and barricaded themselves inside. And that's certainly a violation of the ACLU's principle and the university's rules. They pointed out, and their supporters pointed out, this building was empty at the time. No classes were being held there. No university employees had to leave the building. It was empty of people. That was the point at which the university brought hundreds of police in riot gear onto the campus. And in fact, the chancellor issued a campus-wide safety alert sent to everybody, including me at home, that a violent incident was taking place. And they ordered everyone on campus, tens of thousands of people, to shelter in place. And then they 200 police came on, demolished the encampment, evicted the people from the building, arrested 47 people. The chancellor said he was, quote, heartbroken that he had had to call the police, but said it had been necessary to stop, quoting him, a direct assault on the rights of other students. And the mayor of Irvine replied, taking space on campus or in a building is not a threat to anyone, close quote. Ben Weisner, what do you say?
Yeah, I mean, I'm certainly closer to the mayor than I am to the university president on this one, on this particular set of facts. Again, I don't think that there is a single right answer to how long a university must tolerate the takeover of its building. Certainly, we don't want to see images like the ones we saw at Columbia University here with hundreds of police in riot gear retaking the building. We learned later that one of those officers had actually fired his service weapon in error. Can you imagine if that bullet had struck someone inside? Just the scale of that response to something that was disruptive but nonviolent civil disobedience. I do want to say this on behalf of the protesters, though, because I think something gets lost in the narrative of peaceful protesters being abused by riot police, which is that this was actually quite effective civil disobedience. Sometimes you escalate your tactics in order to achieve an escalated response to bring more attention to it. And this would not have been on the front page of newspapers from Paris to Istanbul to Tel Aviv had it just been protests. It was the police response that made this a global news story and that had a geopolitical impact. And I do want to, as someone who at the age of these students myself was arrested in anti-war protests deliberately, want to say that this is a tactic that sometimes we use in order to bring more attention to our cause.
And this is a time-honored principle of nonviolent protest. It was set forth by Thoreau in his book, Civil Disobedience, then by Martin Luther King in his letter from a Birmingham jail. Protesters intentionally break the law, submit to arrest, accept the penalty to call attention to their issue and demonstrate the depth of their beliefs and their commitments and try to persuade people to join them.
I want to say that I have respect for those students who were willing to put their bodies and freedom on the line for something they believed in deeply. And I don't want to only portray them as victims of an overzealous police response, even though I do think it was an overzealous police response in many of these instances, and that I'm sure many university presidents around the country are privately furious at the president of Columbia for calling in the police first and essentially lighting up the protests on campuses around the country. It backfires too.
And I also want to talk for a minute about negotiating with protesting students, demands that students make. One of the things, reasons the chancellor at UC Irvine gave for calling the police was that the students had made non-negotiable demands. He'd been negotiating with them for a couple of weeks up to that point, but the students demanded the university sever all academic ties with Israel. This is, of course, the goal of the BDS movement. End joint research projects, faculty exchanges, student abroad programs. BDS argues, quoting from their website, quote, "For decades, Israeli universities have played a key role in planning, implementing, and justifying Israel's occupation and apartheid policies while maintaining a uniquely close relationship with the Israeli military," close quote. The UCLA chancellor called this demand for an academic boycott of Israel an assault on the academic freedom rights of our faculty and the free speech rights of faculty and students, close quote. Isn't he right about that?
Well, look, I'm not going to weigh in on whether BDS is the right response to the atrocities that are taking place or wrong, or on academic boycotts, where I think that there are very reasonable points of view on both sides of that debate. And, you know, the ACLU has defended the rights of BDS boycotters without taking a position on the BDS boycotts itself. And that continues to be our lane here. Again, I'm not going to try to put my finger on the scale of who was right between the protesters and the university on the argument, but to say that there are two options. One is to capitulate to what I believe to be unreasonable demands of students, and the other is to call in hundreds of riot police, I think is to ignore the many, many reasonable options in between those two poles.
One more thing in the ACLU principles is schools must resist the pressures placed on them by politicians seeking to exploit campus tensions. The UCLA chancellor is one of the people called to testify before that House committee. Let's talk about that.
Yeah, I mean, look, this isn't my line. I wish it were. Someone said the real outside agitators here are the congressional committees, who are hauling in college presidents, asking them gotcha questions. If there's one thing that I hope is reinforced by the spectacle of these college presidents being called before members of Congress, it's the importance of the First Amendment, which starts with the line, "Congress shall make no law." When you think about speech restrictions that are enforceable by law, I want you to imagine Congresswoman Virginia Fox, because she's the one who's going to be enforcing them. And so if you think that there should be stronger protections against hate speech, who do you think she considers to be hate speech? I guarantee you BDS is going to come up before KKK when she's the one who's making those decisions. So the Congress has been singularly unhelpful here. And really, again, underscoring why we cannot invest government authorities with the power to, you know, make these distinctions between which speech is too offensive and which speech is not offensive. And it's the hardest thing that college presidents have to do. Remember, they are beholden to Congress in a lot of ways. They're so tied up with federal funding. They can be targeted with vexing subpoenas. They have to send their documents. They have to show up and testify. But this really is why they are making seven-figure salaries, right? Is that, they are elected to be the ones to go before Congress and explain to the whole country why free speech and academic freedom are so important. And if that means taking abuse from members of Congress, it has to mean taking abuse. When we saw the Columbia president go up there and not say academic freedom a single time, that was scandalous. These need to be the champions of intellectual freedom and intellectual life and academic freedom. And if they can't play that role in Congress, they don't deserve their jobs.
Ben Wisner, he's director of the ACLU's Speech, Privacy, and Technology Project. Ben, thanks for talking with us today.
Thank you, John.
It's the same old story. This is Living in the USA, and I'm John Wiener, talking about politics, thinking about the left. We had big news about Haiti last week, where violent gangs control 80% of Port-au-Prince. Kenya is finally sending 1,000 police officers to Haiti on what is called a UN security mission. And Joe Biden held a gala state dinner honoring the president of Kenya for doing it. Comment, we turn to Amy Willens. She's written about Haiti for a couple of decades for the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Atlantic, and The Nation. Her most recent book is the award-winning Farewell Fred Voodoo. She was also Jerusalem correspondent for The New Yorker. And she teaches in the literary journalism program at UC Irvine. And she's a 2021 Guggenheim Fellow. Amy, welcome back.
Thanks, John.
Well, the guests at that state dinner honoring Kenya for helping Haiti included Bill and Hillary Clinton, Barack Obama, Sean Penn, and Melinda Gates. Haiti has such powerful friends. Let's talk about each of these and their involvement with Haiti. Let's start with Bill and Hillary.
So Bill and Hillary together, that's an interesting story. They spent their honeymoon in Haiti with the chief executive officer of Citibank, who introduced them to Haiti. Citibank, of course, having a long and torrid history in Haiti, refinancing the nation's debt and making a lot of money off the country over the centuries. And I remember meeting Bill Clinton the one time I met him, and I told him of my interest in Haiti. I had already published a book. And he goes, oh, yeah, me and Hillary, we love Haiti. we went there on our honeymoon. And he and Hillary continued to exalt their connection to Haiti. They loved Haiti, and they had strange ways of expressing it, in my opinion. Bill brought back Aristide to Haiti. So Aristide was the first freely and fairly elected, and perhaps the last freely and fairly elected president of Haiti. And he had been deposed in a coup greenlighted, most probably, by the Bush administration. And then Bill had him in Washington, secreted in a hotel room. And who knows what happened there and what arrangements were made. But eventually, Bill, on the back of an American intervention in Haiti, restored Aristide to the presidency. Incredibly, it was a shocking thing. But Aristide was kind of defanged after that. And he was no longer kind of a people's president and a radical force for changing Haiti. He was becalmed. And then Bill also did this thing that's very famous in Haiti, infamous, called Miami Rice, where rice, actually much of it from Arkansas, subsidized American rice that was going to go to waste and harm the pricing of normal rice in the U.S., was brought into Haiti in the guise of humanitarian aid. Now, one of the mainstays of the Haitian economy at that point was rice. It was raised in the Artibonite Valley, which, if you're from California, is a lot like the Central Valley is. And this Miami rice, it was called Miami because it came through Miami, was a destroyer of the Haitian economy and Haitian food independence. The cultivators of rice in Haiti couldn't compete with the low prices that this rice was brought in on. And it didn't go for free to people. Somehow it got into the hands of big distributors who sold it at the market, undercutting Haitian rice. It led to many things, but one thing it led to was a vast migration of former Haitian farmers into Port-au-Prince, which in 2010, when the earthquake struck, meant that even more people died in overcrowded circumstances than might have died if they had been left on their farms to cultivate rice.
When that earthquake hit in 2010, Obama was president. He showed up at the dinner. What was his role in Haitian history?
Well, the key here is not Obama. It's his Secretary of State. You may remember her. Her name is Hillary Clinton.
Okay.
So Hillary, because she had this real relationship with Haiti, and by the way, that relationship with Haiti, when it's from a U.S. president and his wife, who's then Secretary of State, It's not a normal relationship with Haiti where you go to the beaches and you meet a lot of different kinds of people. It's a relationship with the elite classes, the English-speaking classes, and the people who've informed the State Department for years, including all the way back to the Duvalier administrations, which are actually more rightly called dictatorships. So that's who the Clintons have really been dealing with, the business class, and that's who informs their intelligence on how to deal with Haiti. So when Hillary was Secretary of State, she interfered, perhaps not illegally, but diplomatically, with the Haitian fiddling of election results. And all of this led to a UN-approved, but possibly fraudulent, the election of Michel Martelly. And Michel Martelly, in 2011, became president of Haiti, and his administration was vastly corrupt, had close ties to the drug cartels, and also presided over the enormous thievery of Petrocaribe money that was money that was designated for Haiti by Hugo Chavez in a complicated structured deal about petroleum product being imported into Haiti from Venezuela.
Of course, there's another way to explain Obama's presence at this dinner. He wasn't there for Haiti. He was there for Kenya because his father was a Kenyan. Also on the guest list, Sean Penn. What's his connection to Haiti?
Sean came into Haiti after the earthquake to be, you know, kind of the white mayor of one of the refugee camps and to expiate all of his sins for his violent character and by going to Haiti and being a really good guy. And carrying a Glock pistol, by the way, thank you. And running this refugee camp, which really he did run it. It was one of the best refugee camps. These are internally displaced people by the earthquake, by the way. It was like 20,000 people on the golf course. And he did some good things and he made some mistakes. And yeah, but what he did that made me crazy after having watched him run this displaced persons camp was that he really supported this thing called Caracol. And Caracol was a free trade zone up in northern Haiti, which had no relationship to the earthquake. Nobody died up there. But that's where millions and millions of aid dollars were spent on establishing this free zone.
Let me just fill in here. The free zone is a manufacturing zone to try to bring employment to impoverished Haitians by getting them to work in the textile industry, the lowest rung on the international trade ladder.
Don't even say textile, say garment. They don't make textiles. They only sew t-shirts for you and for me and for Gap and a million other HM companies. And one of the most important people, probably the most important person leading the charge, as they like to say in Washington, leading the charge to get this thing built was Cheryl Mills. Cheryl Mills was at the party, the devil's ball, as I call it. Cheryl was Hillary's chief of staff when Hillary was Secretary of State. So Cheryl worked really hard to arrange the anchor factory for this free zone. And that was Se-A, which is a funny name if you've ever gone to the dentist, which is a South Korean garment company. Terrible labor practices throughout the world, including in Guatemala, where they kicked them out. They kicked Se-A out. And Se-A came to Haiti, and Cheryl organized it so that the head of Se-A could gather support to sweeten the deal, to make him want to come in. His name is Woo Ki Kim. Woo Ki Kim. And at the opening of Caracol in 2013, I think it was, Sean Penn was there, Hillary was there, the Prime Minister of Haiti was there. And Cheryl Mills was there and Woo Ki Kim was there. And Cheryl got up at the podium and said, the most important person here, Hillary looking on, Sean Penn looking on, Prime Minister of Haiti looking on, is Woo Ki Kim. Well, now 3 years after this was opened, Cheryl left the government, left the State Department and opened her own kind of corporate humanitarian entity called Black Ivy. And Black Ivy's, one of Black Ivy's biggest supporters is Se-A and Woo Ki Kim. And they're part of the Clinton Foundation network throughout the world. So, you know, it's a revolving door with Haitian land as a part of it. And I just want to add in convicting this woman that the land on which the Caracol venture was built was Haitian land. Hundreds of farmers were kicked off their land. Their families left. Thousands of people suffered because of this thing that came in. Thousands of people were hired to work there, and thousands of people have since been fired. So it was a bust, except for getting Wookie Kim involved with Black Ivy.
Also on the guest list for what you are calling the Devil's Ball was Melinda Gates. I looked up Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. They are very proud of their giving after the earthquake. $2.5 million to help launch a mobile money service in Haiti called Choo Choo Mobile, and $1 million to Catholic Relief Services, and $1 million to Partners in Health. What do you make of this list of contributions back after 2010, but totaling under $5 million?
Well, it's not that impressive, but I do like that some went to Catholic Relief Services, which is a good organization and organized in Haiti, and Partners in Health, equally very impressive.
That's everybody on my list. You looked at that list, 250 people. What did you notice about it?
There were no Haitians on it, except for one Haitian who had to go. That's Karine Jean-Pierre, who's the president's spokeswoman.
One other thing I noticed about the list, and that brings us to your Minnesota moment, news from my hometown of St. Paul that you won't get from Sean Hannity. Ilhan Omar was a guest. She was, of course, born in Somalia, but it turns out when she was 8, her family fled to Kenya, where they spent 4 years at a refugee camp before coming to the United States. And somebody in the Biden social department knew this. Let's get back to the Kenyan policeman. The first question, of course, is when are they arriving? They've been supposed to arrive for months. The dinner, turns out, was scheduled to coincide with the launch of the mission in Haiti, May 23rd. Only 6 Kenyans showed up in Haiti at this point, and they announced that they discovered the mission would have to be postponed because Haiti lacks armored vehicles to move foreign troops around, lacks radios and communications equipment for the police, and lacks helicopters to evacuate the casualties they anticipate among the foreign police. Are you surprised that they just discovered this last week?
It's just unbelievable. Well, no, of course the State Department knows all of that, but they don't care. It's a show exhibition, the Kenyan force. And apparently no one cares what happens to the Kenyan. I mean, it's amazing. I've known that they don't have helicopters for years. The only helicopters I've seen coming in is in anticipation of the Kenyans arriving. People are fleeing and hiring private helicopters to get out of Haiti because the airports have been closed by the gangs. Thank you, courtesy of Clinton and Obama.
And the other question is, how many policemen are going to come in this first wave, which we are told is now scheduled for 3 weeks from now, the president of Kenya told the BBC. 3 weeks, they're going to show up. How many are going to show up? Some reports say 80, some say 120. Do you have any comment?
1,000 is certainly not adequate. So 80 Kenyan policemen, I don't know what they're going to do. I mean, what really should happen is the Haitian police and the tiny, tiny, tiny Haitian army should be trained to deal with Haiti's problems. Because there's a big problem in Kenya also, which is that there's a lot of division in Kenyan politics, as you might imagine. And President Ruto is not adored by all people in Kenya. And the Kenyan Supreme Court has said, you cannot send our policemen off to police the world. That's the job of armies. You could send our army, but you didn't. You want to send our policemen. You can't do it. So they ruled against Ruto twice now. You may not send them. And that's caused some of the delay. Other of the delays are caused because they're not ready to do the job. They don't speak French, much less Creole. They're not going to know one Haitian from another. They're not going to know a policeman from a gang member. And in fact, often they are one and the same in Haiti right now. So that's a problem. And I think that Biden can congratulate himself on having this party not on the day that the Kenyan force arrives, because who wants to have a big devil's ball in fancy couture outfits with all these, basically, to my mind, criminals at it as Kenyan forces fall to the ground in a bloody pile? So at least that's not happening. And that's a better optic, which is how this administration functions.
One more problem. The United States is going to pay for the whole thing. The State Department has pledged $100 million for the UN Security Force. Biden tried to start with $40 million, but that was blocked on May 17th by two Republicans, Senator Jim Risch of Idaho and House Foreign Relations Committee Chair Michael McCaul from Texas. They say Congress needs to vote on any appropriation for a UN security force in Haiti. What's this about?
They don't approve of the Biden administration doing anything, and they're going to put the brakes on anything they can. But meanwhile, on the ground, the gangs are nervous, and they are like any nervous but violent animal. They are behaving worse and worse. And recently, in a shocking thing for Haiti, they killed two American missionaries, and not just American missionaries, but white American missionaries. And this is like an unheard of act. They kidnapped 17 missionaries about a year ago, but they kidnapped them for ransom, probably got a nice ransom, and they let them go. These people weren't even kidnapped. They were just attacked at their mission. And beyond that, those are two Americans, and it's a terrible tragedy, but the Haitian people are being marauded over by these gangs. Also Haitian people, by the way.
One more question. Does Haiti have a government now? The last time we talked here, it was about the Transitional Presidential Council, which is supposed to set up an election system to choose a new president. How is the transition going?
Well, it's complicated, John. Of course, it's a large transitional council made up of people who all believe opposing things and who all have long histories with each other and who all know very well what each one stands for. From a friend of mine who's not in Haiti, but who talks to these people all the time, he says, you know, the big businessmen are handing over envelopes full of cash, hoping to corrupt this one and that one. And it's just a terrible scene, but they're trying really, really hard to make it come out right. They have issued one directive that they're going to support with money if they can ever get a government going, which is to clean up Port-au-Prince, which has been effectively decimated by the gangs. And they're trying, but they still have to name a prime minister.
Amy Willens on the Devil's Ball in Washington, celebrating Kenyan policemen being dispatched to Haiti. You can read Amy's reports on Haiti at thenation.com. Thank you, Amy.
Thanks, John.
It's the same old story. This is Living in the USA, and I'm John Wiener, talking about politics, thinking about the left. The repeal of Roe v. Wade has not stopped pregnant people from getting abortions, often thanks to providers operating at the edge of the law. For a report on the abortion pill underground, we turn to Amy Littlefield. She's the nation's abortion access correspondent and a journalist who focuses on reproductive rights, healthcare, and religion. She's the author of a forthcoming book, American Crusaders. It's a history of the anti-abortion movement over the last 50 years, to be published in 2026. Amy Littlefield, welcome back.
Thanks so much, John. It's great to be back with you.
Well, if you Google abortion pills in the mail, you get a lot of results. Close to the top is a Planned Parenthood page that says, quote, in order to have the pills mailed to you, you must have an address where you can receive the pills, close quote. In other words, an address in a state where abortion is legal. But is it true that in order to have the pills mailed to you, you must have an address where you can receive the pills?
The short answer, John, is no, absolutely not. There are many different ways to get abortion pills by mail these days, and that is the case even for patients in the reddest of states.
So Planned Parenthood won't mail abortion pills to states where abortion is banned, but other providers will. You report in your cover story for The Nation on a woman in Texas who needed an abortion, Googled abortion pills in the mail, found lots of results, but worried that some of them might take your money and not send anything, or might send pills that didn't work. So what did she do?
So I tried to tell this story of the vast changes in this landscape of abortion access through this patient who I call Kay in the piece. She found out she was pregnant at the end of last year, and she told me she knew three things clearly. I was poor, I had an unwanted pregnancy, and knew I couldn't afford a standard abortion for hundreds of dollars. So she went online to see if it was somehow possible to receive abortion pills through the internet. And guess what? It was not only possible, it was easier and more affordable than she could have ever imagined. What Kay found is this new set of options that are made possible by shield laws, protective pro-choice laws in states like New York and Massachusetts. She found that she could get abortion pills from a licensed clinician mailed to her doorstep in Texas for $150, or if she couldn't afford that, for free.
And how did she decide which of the many people listed in the Google results were trustworthy and good?
And this is part of the amazing, you know, this sort of organic mutual aid infrastructure that's developed on Reddit. So she goes online, she goes to Reddit, and she finds people discussing how they've used these services, how they've used organizations like Aid Access, The Map, and Abuzz. These are services that will provide abortion pills by mail, even in restrictive states. And she finds all these testimonies from strangers who are saying, you know, giving great detail about how, you know, this is how long it took for my pills to get there. This is how I took them. This is how much cramping I had. This is how much bleeding. This is what was available to me. I'd recommend this service over that service. I mean, if you want to learn more about it, I highly recommend checking out a group called OARS, Online Abortion Rescue Squad. They make sure that every post on the abortion Reddit thread gets a knowledgeable and accurate response, because this is all crowdsourced information. And so Kay goes online and finds all these testimonies and is convinced that these services, which she initially thinks they're so easy, they're so cheap, this must be a scam. There's no way it's going to work, right? In her mind, if she wants an abortion, she's going to have to drive at least 12 hours from her home in Texas to the nearest clinic, pay hundreds of dollars. And, you know, it's going to be multiple days and a lot of travel. That is what we have in all of our minds, right? As sort of the way an abortion works. It seems to her so simple, so straightforward, that she can't believe it's real until she goes online and reads all of these stories.
You said one of the secrets of why this works is because of the shield laws that several states have now passed that protect the doctors and clinics that mail abortion pills to red states. The states right now are Massachusetts, Washington, Colorado, Vermont, New York, and California. And among the most prominent and best known is one you report on called Aid Access. Tell us about Aid Access.
They have abortion providers in states like New York that are operating under the shield laws. So that's distinct from more ad hoc grassroots community support networks. One of the first ones was Las Libres, which is a group based out of Mexico that is now working with activists here in the United States. Then they're not licensed clinicians in most cases. They're just people who care and don't think that anyone should be forced to be pregnant if they don't want to be. When Aid Access started providing abortions domestically under the shield laws, it completely changed the game. Because what Aid Access had been doing, this is an organization that was founded by Dr. Rebecca Gompertz, who's, you know, an abortion rights revolutionary. She's a European doctor. And she had started this organization with shipping pills internationally, right? Which can take many weeks.
And she's based where?
When I talked to her, she was in her apartment in Amsterdam. She's operating totally outside of U.S. laws. She actually started out many years ago with an abortion ship. She would sail her abortion boat off the shores of countries where abortion was banned to provide abortions on board, but really to call attention to the draconian nature of abortion bans. She had first seen the impact of unsafe abortions around the world when she was working as a doctor on the Greenpeace ship. So that's her origin story. So basically, she's now working with providers who are based, like Dr. Linda Prine, based in states like New York, who are now providing abortions from those home states. And so because the pills are being shipped domestically, it takes so much less time for them to arrive. And that's really changed the game for people like Kay, who can now order these pills and get them relatively quickly and not be pushed into later gestations because they have to wait for the pills to come from abroad.
Simple question. How much does Aid Access and these other groups charge for abortion pills in the mail?
$150, or if you can't afford that, whatever you can pay, or if you can't afford anything, then for free. Total game changer, right? One of the stories that I heard from Dr. Angel Foster, who's a co-founder of the MAP, is that one person who accessed their service, this is another service that's providing Shield Law telemedicine abortions, they charge $250, but also offer a sliding scale. She said about a third of patients pay $5 or less, and one paid $9.22 for her abortion. And Dr. Foster was like, to me, that was heartbreaking because it's such a specific amount. In her mind, she sees someone counting out their pennies on a kitchen table, right, to get to 22 cents.
Big picture. Has the repeal of Roe, now 2 years ago, succeeded in reducing the number of abortions in the United States?
It sure has not, John. And boy, are anti-abortion folks big mad about that fact. In fact, you know, and I don't want to be glib here because this is when you look at the full scope of the landscape now, almost 2 years out from the Dobbs decision, it is just rife with contradictions. So it is simultaneously true that tens of thousands of people have been unable to terminate their pregnancies, right, and have been forced to give birth. And it is also true at the same time, right? We have to hold these two things at once, that the number of abortions in the United States actually increased last year, in large part because of the rising availability of telemedicine abortions. And so it's actually reached the highest number since 2011. Anti-abortion folks are not happy about the fact that, you know, their crowning achievement that they worked for 50 years to reach, overturning Roe v. Wade, has in fact not diminished the number of abortions.
And what do we know about women in the states where abortion has been banned?
We know that thousands of pregnant people in states where abortion has been banned have been forced to give birth. I looked at a study from the nonprofit Institute of Labor Economics that found the birth rate in states with total abortion bans increased by 2.3% compared to states where abortion was protected, which amounts to an estimated 32,000 more births per year. I mean, it's interesting. One thing that really stood out to me from that study is that the increase was especially high among Latinas, among women in their early 20s, and among Texans, whose average driving distance to a clinic had increased by 453 miles. Undocumented Texans who live in the Rio Grande Valley in South Texas are cut off by Border Patrol checkpoints from any states to the north where abortion remains legal. Yeah. So, again, those folks now would be able to access Shield Law abortions if they understood that it takes a certain amount of, you know, tolerance for risk in this untested environment, but they may not know about that. And they may assume, as Kay did before she started doing her research, that they would have to travel past these border patrol checkpoints in order to get to the nearest clinic.
Another big picture question. What do we know about the proportion of abortions that now are medication abortions rather than in-clinic surgical procedures?
During the COVID pandemic, you know, which I shouldn't say during the pandemic, of course, that's still ongoing, but early in the pandemic, the Food and Drug Administration eased its in-person dispensing requirement for mifepristone, which is the first of two medications generally used in a medication abortion. And before that, you had to go to a clinic to actually pick it up in person, right? So some brick and mortar clinics began to offer telemedicine abortions, new virtual clinics cropped up. And now medication abortions account for 63% of all abortions in the formal healthcare system, which is up from 53% in 2020. And this is an undercount, right? Because it doesn't include abortions that are provided in the states where abortion is banned by this newer, smaller subset we've been discussing of Shield Law telemedicine providers that are willing to ship to states where abortion is entirely banned.
Question about the states with Shield laws. So there are these six states, and they say, for example, even if Texas indicts a doctor in California for prescribing and shipping abortion pills to Texas, California will refuse to extradite that doctor for trial in Texas. So this is really a conflict between states. Conflicts between states end up at the Supreme Court. And I imagine the anti-abortion movement will want to test these laws, especially given the nature of the Supreme Court these days. If and when this gets to the Supreme Court, there's no federal law that says you can't ship abortion medication from, say, California to Texas. Or is there?
John, I'm going to have to put you in a time machine here, and we're going to have to take a little trip back to 1873 for me to answer that question. In 1873, there's a federal law passed, the Comstock Act, named for the anti-vice crusader Anthony Comstock, a man known for his rabid pursuit of all things lewd and obscene, going after everything from pornographic drawings to abortion, drugs, and paraphernalia. And basically, under this law, which was created to stamp out obscenity, right? And in an era where any kind of extramarital sexual behavior was, you know, ooh, that was a real crisis, you know, for society. The Comstock Act, if you read it in a literal fashion, as anti-abortion activists do, it could be read as a de facto nationwide ban on the mailing of abortion drugs and devices, which would in effect shut down not just abortion medication mailing, but in fact, the mailing of things like equipment that would be needed to perform a procedural abortion. And so this could in effect shut down, you know, brick and mortar clinics if it's read in a particular way by the federal courts. So that's one question that we have. Now, the Comstock Act has already been entertained by the Supreme Court. We know that there are two conservative justices. Anyone have a wild guess about who? Right?
Yeah, right.
Thomas and Alito, who are, you know, just chomping at the bit, it seems, to revive the Comstock Act. And let's just step back and acknowledge here, right? Like, this is the best shot they have at a nationwide abortion ban in this era of surging popularity of abortion rights. Like, no Republicans really want to touch the issue right now. And so we are just not going to see a nationwide ban passed in the traditional Democratic sense. And so, you know, a law from 1873, dusting that off and trying to revive the ghost of Anthony Comstock has been really appealing. So that's the nationwide ban. Other than that, what we have basically is the next frontier of the legal fight over the future of medication abortion, because it's really unclear how the courts are going to view these shield laws. The providers that I spoke to who are operating under these shield laws say they're really confident that these laws work. They feel protected. They feel like even if Texas tries to extradite them, their states like New York are going to protect them. However, you know, they do take precautions, like not traveling to states where there might be a warrant out for their arrest that they don't know about. You know, I talked to legal experts like Mary Ziegler, who said she thinks there's a very real potential that courts rule that states like Texas can, in fact, come for shield law providers. And so it's a question that I think we're likely to see play out in the coming years in the federal courts.
And this is clearly something that Planned Parenthood is concerned about. I open by saying the Planned Parenthood affiliates in the states that do have shield laws nevertheless refuse to mail abortion pills to states where it's illegal. California Planned Parenthood will only send you pills in California. Why aren't the state shield laws enough for Planned Parenthood, the biggest, most powerful organization we've got?
Yeah, it's a great question. And, you know, one answer, and again, I talked to Dr. Angel Foster, who's the co-founder of one of three services that is providing these shield law telemedicine abortions. So there's Abuzz, the MAP, and Aid Access that are providing these services in states where abortion is banned and restricted. And she said, look, the medical profession is quite conservative. The legal profession is quite conservative. Those things are not working in the favor of people who are trying to innovate, who are trying to get creative. Organizations like Planned Parenthood that have boards of directors, attorneys advising them, big endowments that, you know, under laws like Texas SB 8, where you can sue people for civil damages for aiding or abetting an abortion, right? there's a lot to lose and there's a lot of caution in these groups, you know, and that's been true for a long time. Julie F. Kay, for example, the attorney who worked with Dr. Linda Prine and Dr. Maggie Carpenter to found the Abortion Coalition for Telemedicine, you know, she told me in the beginning they just were not getting the support they needed from mainstream pro-choice organizations. And so that's why they had to go and found this whole separate entity to pursue these shield law abortions, which now have revolutionized the whole landscape. I mean, it's not the first time, for example, Dr. Linda Prine, who's, you know, this, she's 72 years old. She's an abortion provider. She's based in New York. I spent a day with her watching her provide abortions through Aid Access and also answer the miscarriage and abortion hotline that she co-founded. This is an information line that anybody can call while they're in the process of taking abortion medication and ask a doctor questions. And I watched her answering these calls, you know, from someone who wanted to know how far back in the vagina the pills need to go, someone who wanted to know, you know, how much I'm feeling lightheaded, what should I do? You know, text message came in with that. So she's responding to these. And in the beginning, you know, the like attorneys within the movement were like, this is a terrible idea. You know, things could go wrong. And she did it anyway. So I think on some level, you're seeing differences within the movement about the level of risk people are willing to take. And it's often the case that the larger organizations that have more lawyers, more, you know, yes, conservative board members in the mix are going to be the most risk averse. Part of that is shield laws protect providers, right? For people who are accessing medication abortion, it's extremely rare for them to get in legal trouble, but it only takes a couple high profile cases of somebody, you know, getting arrested or someone, as we've seen with, you know, the anti-abortion attorney, Jonathan Mitchell, going after people who have left the state for abortions on behalf of their ex-partners. You know, it only takes a few cases like that for people to feel really terrified if they're in a banned state when they access these abortions. So I do want to point out that there's this disconnect between, you know, logistically, it's easier than it ever has been for somebody in a state like Texas to get a telemedicine abortion because it takes less time. It's free if they need it to be free. It's all through the mail. They have a licensed clinician there if they need one. On the other hand, they might feel terrified, you know, they might feel alone because that help is not right next door. They might be afraid of what happens if they go to the hospital. And we know that there have been cases of people criminalized even before the Dobbs decision. And so it's important to sort of hold these two. This is why it's very hard to define the reality of post-Dobbs abortion access, you know, in a single sentence, because it's so dependent, not just on where you live, but on the impression that you have about your level of risk, on things like, do you have an abusive partner who might report you to police, on, you know, whether you are already subject to surveillance and the different contacts with the carceral state that could, you know, make it higher risk. So, you know, there's a lot going on and a lot changing all at once. And so I hope this piece sort of gives people an overview of those discordant realities.
Amy Littlefield, her article, The Abortion Pill Underground, is the cover story in the new issue of The Nation magazine. You can read it online at thenation.com. Amy, thanks for this report, and thanks for talking with us today.
Thank you so much, John. Always a pleasure.
That's it for Living in the USA for today. Our producer and social media maven is Renee Reynolds. Our audio editor is Alan Minsky. Thanks as always to Rai Cooter for our theme music, Mambo Sinuendo. Living in the USA is recorded and produced at our Blythe Avenue studios in Los Angeles. If you missed part of this show or any of our recent shows, you can listen online anytime you want at applepodcast.com, Living in the USA. I'm John Wiener. We'll be back next week talking about politics, thinking about the left, and living in the USA.